hello, my sweet friends. This is your host, Chloe Lionheart, and you are listening to the Down With My Demons podcast. Hey, hey, happy Thursday, or whatever day you're listening to this. Today, I want to talk about PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, and CPTSD, which is complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And before I get into it, I want to name that I'm going to briefly touch on suicidal ideation. So please be aware of that. That will be in here at some point. And I'm going to be talking about trauma. So take care of yourself always. So post-traumatic stress disorder was formerly considered an anxiety disorder within our diagnostic manual in the United States. And recently, as of 2013, it was moved to the category of trauma and stress-related disorders, which is a really big deal because the field of psychology and mental health is still relatively new. It's kind of still a baby in relation to a lot of the sciences out there. And we have infinite space and there's infinite exploration to be done about the human experience and about our psychological lives and about the soul. And we will continue as a field to be unpacking and discovering nuances and understanding more fully the conditions that plague a lot of us and rewriting what we know about certain things as more information is accessed and as more studies are conducted. So that's one of the things I love about this field and about studying psychology in general, is that we only have up from here to go. So I want to talk about the differences between PTSD and CPTSD. But before that, too, the reason I'm bringing these things up is because they're really popular at the moment, and you'll probably come into contact with these words. There's like a lot of information on TikTok. There's a lot of information on YouTube and on Instagram and the news, and people like Gabor Mate, a former family medicine practitioner, are talking a lot about these things in relationship to other diagnoses or other disorders that we experience, such as some personality disorders, which are linked to trauma and stress, and also ADHD and ADD, any attention disorder, are closely linked to stress and trauma as well. So I feel like they're important to know the difference between these two things. Just to clarify, CPTSD, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, is not a diagnosis in our diagnostic and statistical model yet. It is more than a concept now. It is definitely getting a lot more traction, a lot more serious of a thing, and there's a lot more information out there to work with, but it is not a diagnosis yet. Just want that to be clear. Throughout the episode, I'll talk about those of us who experience complex post-traumatic stress disorder as a disorder. Just let it ride, all right? Because that's the language that I've got for now, and we're going to have to just please bear with me as we go along. Diagnoses are helpful for some. If you've lived your life unsure of what is happening to you or why you behave in a certain way or question why some things are challenging for you or are really frustrated with difficulties or struggles in relationships or work or just in society in general and connecting, getting a diagnosis through your practitioners and your like team of support can be incredibly life-saving and really can just be really helpful. to have a name for something, to have a direction to go in. And for many, many, many different cultures and many different walks of life and people, these Western diagnoses are like not helpful. It's not the way that all societies and cultures look at them. So just wanted to name that as well. In no way is this episode meant to diagnose anyone. So please do seek support and analysis and assessment if you feel really resonant with things that I'm saying and feel as if you'd like to get further information or further support on that. Do a little bit of research. Reach out to a doctor, reach out to a therapist, reach out to, your community and network of people. So here's the difference between PTSD and CPTSD. PTSD is trauma that, or it's a stress induced from a singular traumatic event. This could be something like a natural disaster, a car accident, sexual violence, something life-threatening, and it's a singular event. So for instance, if you were around or if a parent or someone was around during 9/11, that was a pretty terrifying event for all of us in the U.S., and especially those of us who were in the Northeast. And even if, no one we knew were killed or hurt, or we weren't there, even watching it over and over and over again for like weeks and months afterwards is, a reminder of this singular traumatic event, which caused an enormous amount of stress for people. PTSD doesn't occur as a symptom of something like a terminal illness diagnosis. It's not moments of being scolded by like a boss or like embarrassed or shamed or something. It has to actually be like a very life-threatening event. Also, not all traumas group to create PTSD. So it really depends on your nervous system and your body, because much of the emotional underpinnings and workings of PTSD symptoms are directly linked to our central nervous system. So it very much plays into how we already perceive the world and genetically how sensitive we are, how sensitive our nervous systems are, and our general, neurological capacity and functioning, and whether or not we feel or have been taught the proper skills to navigate really challenging things such as that. So there's very clear changes to the brain with PTSD, as there is CPTSD, but it impacts our amygdala and our hippocampus. And our amygdala is what processes the regulation of our autonomic nervous system and endocrine functions. So much of it is our decision-making and adaptations of instinctive and motivational behaviors to changes in the environment through implicit associative learning. So changes in short and long-term plasticity in our brain. It's also this activation of our fight, flight, freeze, or fawn response. If you're like, Chloe, what the heck, WTF, is the autonomic nervous system? Good question. So glad you asked. The autonomic nervous system regulates the functioning of our internal organs, such as our heart and our stomach and our intestines. And it's all about the functions that are involuntary and reflexive. So our heart beats faster when we're scared, like that kind of thing. In emergencies, it's the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And in non-emergencies, it's our rest and digest centers. It's regulating the organs, glands, muscles. So that's that. Also, our hippocampus is what is regulating our learning, memory encoding, memory consolidation, and our spatial navigation. It's also a really integral part of our limbic system, which is really directly related to our like instincts and our mood. And it controls a lot of basic emotions like fear, pleasure, anger, and our drives like hunger, sex, dominance, and also caring for others, particularly our children and other people's children. So memory, emotions, arousal. So you see where I'm getting at here. And now I guess it's clearer too to understand why PTSD can also be linked to things like ADHD and attention disorders and personality disorders even. So why is it easier to understand the brain functions now that I've named them? Because the disorders we've talked about, kind of personality disorders, attention disorders, and stress and trauma disorders, are often relational. They impact our sense of self, our feelings of being in the world, our survival responses, emotional regulation challenges, not remembering things or spacing out, physical sensations, body responses that are going on internally before they are going on externally, making our ability to make sense of things, our drives, impulses, and the control of those things. So it's a bit of a perfect storm. So there's four groups of symptoms that make up PTSD. And they all need to be happening pretty much at like the same time when navigating a post-traumatic event. So this is the way that the brain and the body are going to be responding to a singular traumatic event that's just happened. So the first group is intrusion symptoms, which is like memories of the event that are appearing out of nowhere. It could be nightmares that are reoccurring. Next is avoidant symptoms, which are us wanting to avoid or like really having this feeling repelled away from things that remind us of the singular trauma that happened. And then negative thoughts and moods are also associated. So kind of doom prepping, or thinking that you're not going to live very long, or thinking that something bad is about to happen, that like preparation in the body of doom. And also, I'm sure, but not lastly, like being on the edge and hypersensitivity. So this is our emotional outbursts, anger, panic, things like that. So that is PTSD. What I really want to unpack today, particularly, is CPTSD, which was formerly just a concept. There are so many of us out there living with this day to day, and it has a lot to do with how we view ourselves and how we perceive the world. So the difference is that complex post-traumatic stress disorder is from chronic trauma over time, usually starting in childhood, and predominantly due to physical, emotional, sexual abuse or violence, or also neglect. So trauma is going to shape the development and personality in our brains when we're growing up. And why this is so complex is because when we were developing, our environment plays a huge part in how that is solidifying for us. So our understanding of whether or not the world is a safe place, or whether or not people are okay to trust, or whether or not love is safe, or whether or not we are okay in our bodies or worthy of love, or if we think we're good people, or if we like learn to accept and care for ourselves, or even our ability to regulate ourselves emotionally and be really resilient against the very normal challenges and struggles of life. That's not saying that someone who grows up with chronic trauma, that's not normal. I mean, unfortunately, it's like probably more normal than it's ever been. Although I guess we're just better at diagnosing or assessing now. But it very much comes as a result of an environment and experiences that we didn't cause and that we didn't deserve. And it vastly impacts how we experience life as adults and our relationships and our work life and our school life and what it feels like to be in our bodies and feel our feelings and very much our self-concept. So it's really popular right now to talk about self-awareness, and there's a reason for that. Because the more that we can become aware of ourselves and our patterns, the more easily we can start rewriting those patterns and interrupting our harmful behaviors and trying out new things and practicing new things. So yeah, CPTSD very much impacts our behavioral, if we have behavioral struggles, relationship struggles, emotional regulation struggles, anxiety. It's linked to depression, like a chronic depression, which is called dysthymia. Dysthymia is kind of like Eeyore. You can be happy, but there's this sort of gray cloud always lingering around. And it can also be emotional numbing and distancing from people and connection. Emotional numbing can look like a lot of things. It can look like addiction. It can look like overeating, undereating. It can look like just doom scrolling and dissociating, like leaving our bodies. Also having a really difficult self-image and seeing ourselves as bad or broken or damaged or hopeless or powerless, which is not our fault, those of us with CPTSD. Also really closely related to distortion of body image. Eating disorders and body dysmorphia. And body dysmorphia, which is such a spectrum, and it's kind of hard not to have body dysmorphia with our media and societal expectations in the West. It's really challenging, and I'm sure everywhere, honestly. But particularly in the West, when we're bombarded by like propaganda and cultural requirements or standards of beauty or health or whatnot. And the dysmorphia means that we can't really see ourselves for how we are. So someone who is 100 pounds and 30 years old could look in the mirror and see themselves as like super fat. That's like body dysmorphia. So complex post-traumatic stress disorder is serious emotional disruption over the early years. And unfortunately, it's hardwired into our brain. It impacts the size of different aspects of the brain that are really important for, you know, these things that we've been talking about: emotions, behaviors, memory, focusing, concentration, general functioning, impulse control. And even though it's hardwired and that makes things a little bit more challenging, nothing is like permanent. I believe that everything is workable. Nothing is impossible. So it's linked, you know, to memory problems. Also a lot of shame and potentially sleep problems. A lot of cognitive shifts. So a cognitive shift is basically our thinking and perceiving. And this goes into what they call cognitive distortions, which are our distorted idea of ourselves in the world and in relationship to other people and in relationship to experiences. And oftentimes, cognitive distortions are things that are told to us as kids. So if someone, like a teacher, ever called us stupid, we could instill that into us as a cognitive distortion. From then on, somewhere deep inside of us, we have this belief that we're stupid because someone told us that long ago, who was older or whatever. It could be that we're unlovable, that we're too much. You see where I'm going with this. We can have a whole other episode about cognitive distortions as well. And oftentimes people who have CPTSD will often struggle with being present consistently. They will sometimes kind of like wander off and like look elsewhere or glaze over in a conversation and then have to ask someone, hey, will you repeat this? Or can you tell me this thing again? Because they sort of unconsciously start to dissociate from the body. It really makes it hard to focus at work, at school, in relationships in general. So attention, memory, and concentration all linked to the central nervous system, which I find so interesting. And I have a little bit of a theory about this, because usually when someone with this disorder is like drifting off into space, it's as if like some imaginary thing is like pulling them. It's a pulling distraction of sorts. And my theory about this is that in a moment of trauma and also in chronic trauma, that it becomes really terrifying for our souls to continue being in our body. And so our soul gets really smart and really good at leaving the body and kind of hovering above us. Think back if you've ever had that experience where something was happening and you kind of felt like you were floating above yourself. Not to say that that is trauma, but that sensation is what I'm talking about here. It's kind of a fragmenting to be able to survive. And if our soul or spirit isn't in the body where the nervous system is and like where those things are being felt, emotions, sensations, whatnot, then the soul has an easier time. It then comes back down into the body and we, you know, freak out, fuck out, whatever it is. But oftentimes in that extreme moment, the heightened state, the most intense part of a trauma, we will not be in the body. So my idea is that when we're really distracted as people with CPTSD, it's that we're missing pieces of ourselves. There are parts of us that are fragmented a little bit, and it is going to require retrieving those parts of ourselves and bringing them back into ourselves, into our hearts, and being with them and showing them a lot of care and creating safety for them to come home to us. And there are a lot of medicine people and energy workers and spiritual practitioners who do what's called a soul retrieval, which is calling bits of ourselves back into us. And there's, you know, this is what therapy is great at. It calls those things back home. It names those things that happened. It brings them forward into a space, into a held container in a room with a trusted other individual, professional individual to be looked at and processed, and they lose their charge in that way. So it's easier for us to then talk about them moving forward, and we can then bit by bit process them and help to integrate those parts of ourselves back in. So there are a lot of ways that CPTSD shows up. And let me just start off by saying, the second that you were born, and even before that, you were worthy of all of the love in the world. You were already wonderful and deserving of love and lovable and valuable on this earth. And no matter what you do in your life, that unit of worth is never going away. That doesn't excuse any behaviors, and it doesn't change the fact that we are so special and needed and wonderful already. Period. And CPTSD makes it really fucking hard to believe that. Because if someone told us or treated us in such a way that told us or taught us the opposite of that, and that has been our environment, or that was our environment, that was our experience, that was the norm, then our understanding of the world and of people in it is that it's not fucking safe. That love is not safe, and that it equals pain, and that if we trust people, then we're in danger, or that if we're vulnerable, then we're at risk of being hurt. And it's really confusing, and it's fucking courageous as hell to continue to fight and learn and be with ourselves and to try to love ourselves. It's making me feel pretty emotional. It's really hard. I think Albert Einstein said, if you judge a fish by its ability to fly, it will live its whole life thinking it's stupid. And we live in a world that is, you know, tough in that way. It either requires us to be really good at flying, or requires us to be really good at swimming. But to show up every day, to hear that part of our heart, even if it's so small, that whispers to us that we are worth it. It's so brave to keep going. It's really brave to not give up. It's brave to work at it, to work at loving ourselves and learning to see ourselves as someone we like. It's not for the faint of heart. and a deep bow of gratitude to all of you out there who continue fighting. My heart goes out to you. You're not alone. Okay. Sometimes I feel like my heart like gets so full that it spills out of my eyes. And someone once told me that a mentor, a spiritual guide, teacher once told me that our tears are holy water. So I like to bless myself with them. And I feel really grateful for the ability to cry. It feels like such a blessing to be able to like release energy in that way. And it's so sweet to let my heart fill up so that it literally spills out of me. Not a bad problem, I guess. Although not always appropriate. So ways that CPTSD can show up is, you know, fear of trusting others and fear of love. So if our parents, you know, were the ones that were constantly yelling at us or abused us in some way, or even like weren't ever around and totally neglected our needs or disregarded our emotions, whatever it was, even if they tried their hardest, you know, that had an impact on us. And it makes it really hard to trust love because we're born, you know, needing them and requiring them to care for us. And that's usually our first experience of love. Whoever is our caregiver is the first experience of that need and connection and belonging and vulnerability and like true intimacy. And if that was a dangerous relationship and a dangerous thing for us to feel, then it's not going to be easy for us to trust people in adulthood. Trust is going to feel physically terrifying. And if we trust someone, those of us with CPTSD, then our trust is really easily broken, which is unfortunate. And it's terrifying to love people and to lean into that. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, like, fuck, I love cinnamon rolls. I'm talking like romantic relationship. Learning to really trust your friends. Really learning to trust in loving yourself. That can be challenging. Also, feelings of chronic aloneness. This is that feeling of there's no one else that's experienced this but me, or no one understands, or I can't talk about this because no one around me knows what this is like. It can feel really isolating, and we often will isolate ourselves because of this. We physically separate ourselves from others and perpetuate this feeling of aloneness. And even in a crowded room, we can feel alone. It's this embodiment of, I've been through something that I don't know if anyone else in here has experienced, and that's shaped me in such a way that I don't even want to admit that in this room. Because God forbid I'm further othered. God forbid I talk about this thing that happened to me or say it out loud and then no one wants to be around me anymore. It's scary. So it takes a lot of time and patience from both ourselves and those around us with us in the process of healing from complex trauma, to learn to believe that it's going to be okay. And learning, like I said last week, that all things are information. So just because something doesn't happen for us right now, or maybe we used to be friends with someone and now we're not, or whatever, that's not necessarily a reflection of our worth, right? Because again, from when we were born, that unit of worth isn't changing at all. So it takes time to like rewrite that pattern and then start to feel the safety in our body and to like actually receive love and let it in. Oftentimes, you know, that chronic aloneness is because we built this stone wall around ourselves, like I've talked about, I think, in one of the first episodes, where we've protected ourselves, which is so smart of our brains and our souls, right? Like, genius idea. And yet it keeps all of the good stuff out. So healing these things and rewriting these patterns and beliefs takes like us punching out all those bricks and letting some of the light in. Even if it rains on us, or even if the wind blows, or even if there's a fire, or whatever there is, because life's going to hand us some shit. But knowing that there's a lot of goodness and looking for it. So along with that, it shows up in challenges with emotional regulation and an addiction to chaos. If we grew up in a household that there was always yelling, then yelling is going to be this like baseline of comfort for us. It's going to feel the most normal. And when things are calm and still and peaceful, it's going to set off fucking alarm bells inside of us. It's going to alert us and let us know that something's horribly fucking wrong. That's not our fault. That's just what we're used to. So if we are attracted to someone new and it's because we feel insane around them and there's this like intense connection and it's so crazy and it's really like passionate and it's really volatile in whatever fucking way and it's super loud and it's crazy, like that's probably chaos, right? That's not like a peaceful, content, calm, loving relationship that's gonna stand the test of time. But those relationships are fucking horrifying for us. So learning to not look for what is like the most extreme as the signifier of love, but learning how to reparent ourselves, which we'll talk about in a different episode. I heard someone today refer to reparenting as forgetting everything we've been taught, like letting go of everything we've learned, which is really interesting. And there will be an episode on reparenting as well, so I'll leave that there. Emotional dysregulation and challenges with emotional regulation essentially means that we didn't learn the skills as a kid to be able to soothe ourselves really easily. So when an emotion comes up, oftentimes, if we are in this state of like survival, it will come up really strong and fast and hard. And it's more challenging to get ourselves back into a neutral place without a lot of practice, without a lot of skills-based work, and without that mindfulness piece. So the mindfulness piece is just forever going to come into this. Self-awareness is forever coming into this. And mindfulness, you know, and like meditation, as we've maybe touched on before, is just calling yourself back home and like witnessing your own thoughts instead of being hooked by them. Just being like, oh, look at that thing. Or wow, I'm being visited by this emotion right now. That's curious. Oh, okay. See you, emotion. Walk on by. In terms of emotions as well, another way that this can show up is in emotional flashbacks, which can be visual, somatic, meaning the body, or just emotional, internal, implicit. Implicit just being in the body. So that means that a moment or a situation or a circumstance can trigger us and trigger our bodies in a way that transports us back to a time and a feeling, which may not correlate to what's happening in the present moment, but it feels like so real. Like all of a sudden those alarm bells again go off, even if it's something so benign, such as you're waiting in line. And all of a sudden you start panicking. Or it could be someone sets a boundary with you or says no. And all of a sudden you see that as an immediate abandonment and or an attack. Or it could be even that someone treats us poorly And then all of a sudden we're like infatuated by them. So it shows up in many ways. It's our body's way of responding to what it knows to be the pattern, or it recognizes the situation as something to like be very cautious of and aware of. And it immediately turns on all the survival techniques in us. And that's how we're reacting to a situation. Everyone in the Western world's favorite, hypervigilance and a need for control, otherwise known as preparing for the worst, and perfectionism. When we are struggling with perfectionism, we're basically hypervigilant while thinking about what could go wrong. And we're constantly looking out for situations that are threatening or that might go awry or that we know trigger us. Or trigger our belief that we're not okay, or this like not okay part of us. So we will even unconsciously avoid certain things, knowing that they're going to trigger us into a situation, instead of leaning more into challenge and seeing the opportunity as just that, an opportunity to grow and evolve and maybe do something different than we've ever done before. So perfectionism, that need for control, and the hypervigilance in our paying attention and being hyper aware of what's going on around us is how we stayed alive. It's how we took care of ourselves. If we knew that we were not safe at some point, particularly in childhood, then we need to know who just walked into the room and how they're feeling, or the way that they're speaking, or the way that they're moving their body. We need to know what's happening around us as it relates to how we're then going to experience life in that situation, because that could have been the thing that saved our lives back in the day. If someone grew up with a really angry parent who struggled with rage or who struggled with substance abuse, whatever, and we know that every time they come home and they throw their bag down and they rip their jacket off and they toss their shoes, we know that something bad's going to happen if we see that. Then any time in our life that we see that, our body immediately goes into this response of, I'm under attack. So we learn to be extremely hyper aware of what is happening around us. And then I'll go back to that emotional flashback thing, whereas just because we perceive something as a threat does not necessarily mean it is a threat. Which is really annoying and very confusing, especially when we're first beginning to unpack a lot of this. For instance, one of mine is whispering. Whispering is like an immediate trigger for me. I instantly go into this space of being bullied as a kid brutally and not having this feeling of belonging, or even having family members like talk poorly about me behind my back, or even me being in the room gaslighting me in my emotional experience or whatever it was. Oftentimes those things that were spoken about me that were negative were whispered. So whispering is this instant feeling of hypervigilance where I now run through, or in the past I've had patterns of running through these thoughts of, oh, nobody likes me. Okay, well, if no one likes me, I guess I accept that. So now I should probably leave the room, or maybe they don't really want to be my friends, or maybe I shouldn't trust them as much, or maybe like I shouldn't tell them as much about myself. I like go into this roller coaster ride of reasons for the whispering, and in places or communities or in gatherings of friends or wherever it is that I feel really close to and safe with, I'll actually ask. I'll say like, hey, The whispering is really challenging for me. I have this narrative that crops up into my head. I know whatever you're saying, you probably want to keep it secret, but I'm just letting you know that this is a thing for me. So, and also with perfectionism, maybe we grew up feeling that or experiencing not getting any attention or love or support or care from those around us unless we were succeeding in something and kind of a perceived win, like doing really well in school or looking really beautiful or nice or being really strong and fast or being really nice and quiet, whatever it was. We then will give that like 150% of our energy, if that is even possible, to make sure that we're constantly succeeding in these perceived ways, that we're always looking good, that we're never showing any weakness, that we're never showing any faults, that people always see us as doing extremely well or being very financially stable or being very emotionally stable or just any sort of stable. Is that perfectionism? Please perceive me as doing extremely well so that you'll want to like me and that you won't leave me and abandon me. It's that roller coaster of thoughts again. I see this so much, and this is my bias and probably projections of my own shadow and all my own shit, but I see a lot of this in social media. We don't see the nitty gritty. We don't see the like nose running, mascara running, blah, blah, blah moments of life. So I guess people are more into that these days and whatever. But yeah, we don't see as much of that as we do these very curated experiences of perfect life and how wonderful everyone's doing and how successful they're being. I do think it's important to celebrate ourselves. And of course, we're more likely to be like taking pictures and taking videos and wanting to connect with people when we're feeling really good. And it's not a depiction of real life. I talk about this in my episode on New Age spiritual bypassing a bit about the self-care. Self-care is also paying your fucking bills, not just taking bubble baths. And I much prefer the bubble bath version myself. So yeah, that's kind of the hypervigilance, the need for control. If we felt out of control forever, if we never felt like we could get a hold of things or a handle on things, we never had a say, we always felt terrible. Maybe we really felt overwhelmed a lot in places that we were required to be or go, or we didn't feel aligned with anything that was going on around us for such a long time. It's extremely overwhelming to be in that kind of environment. It feels very out of control. And those emotions too, like being really emotional can feel really out of control as well. Particularly if people praised us when we were younger or praised us at any point for being extremely docile and submissive. Tough. It's really challenging and scary and tough to let ourselves like feel some big stuff. And really important. So moving on to number 6, who's counting, is struggling to maintain faith. So when we experience an extreme trauma or progression of extreme traumas, it can be challenging to maintain an idea of it's going to be okay, life's going to work out, I believe that there's something out there that has my back. Whatever you believe in, faith can be in anything. Faith can be in that the sun is going to rise tomorrow. And we experience moments that are so extreme and so dark and so unfathomable, it can seem like the sun's not going to rise tomorrow. Wars are going on right now in the world. Whole countries being destroyed and their people. There's massive genocide happening right now. Faith does keep people together, and sometimes after experiences like that, can be really hard to maintain our belief that the life is beautiful or things are gonna all be okay in the end. that can feel really far away. I've talked about reparenting, but another one is this wounded inner child that's desperate for our love and reparenting. It shows up as us not taking care of ourselves and then kind of falling apart because we really needed someone in our lives growing up to help us to go to bed on time in a way that felt really loving and safe and supported, or someone who did take us to the doctor or the dentist or whomever when we needed to be there, or school, someone who got us to school on time, or someone that helped us with our homework, or someone that, you know, tended to us when we got hurt or felt sad or whatever it is. So now in our adulthood, how this shows up is sometimes, you know, we'll stay awake too long, even though it's fucking, it's so intense for our bodies and we're struggling, but we can't go to sleep, or how we really struggle to feed ourselves 3 meals a day. We really struggle to feed ourselves things that make us feel good, or we really struggle to move our bodies because there isn't that encouragement deep down in there to tend to ourselves and care for ourselves. Or we are workaholics when really we just need a break. We just need to take some time to rest. So that reparenting, unlearning this hustle and bustle and rush culture, unlearning this toxic consumerism culture to really tend to ourselves, that wounded child in us is like desperate for us to wrap it in a blankie and watch cartoons and eat cereal and like feel cozy for a second. A big way that this CPTSD shows up is in this feeling of helplessness and toxic shame. Toxic, it's a word I've already used in the episode. It's a word that gets thrown around a lot. I hesitate with that. What I mean by toxic shame is that it literally, physically is toxic to our body and our souls. It is like drinking the poison. And feelings of helplessness is in believing that we can't do anything because maybe we tried as kids and we failed, or someone didn't support us, or someone wasn't there to help pick us back up, or we weren't even encouraged to get back up. There's this deep feeling that we can't do anything, that we're not good enough, that we're fundamentally broken, that we'll never get it right, that we fuck everything up, that we won't ever figure it out, that no one will ever love us, we won't ever feel safe. And that's so dangerous. It's dangerous for us to feel that, and it's so real, and it's so happening, and it's really intoxicating. It's really easy to be seduced by that. Particularly if that is what that type of internal chaos is what feels more validating for us than some sort of affirmation in the moment. And again, the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt is I did something wrong. Shame is I am the thing that's wrong. Guilt, very helpful. Shame, not as helpful. Unless you're a sociopath. Another way this shows up is in this like constant search for a rescuer, which isn't conscious. It's looking for the someone to rescue us from our own pain, thinking that we're looking for the love of our life that we're going to meet, and all of a sudden we're not going to feel any of our pain anymore, and we're just going to feel so safe and so loved that it will always work out, and it's never going to be hard, and that life will be roses all the time. And I wish that for every single one of us on this planet, 100%. And that's not realistic. People aren't perfect. We all come into this life, you know, and go through things and then bring all those things into relationship with each other. So looking for a rescuer makes a lot of sense. We want someone to fight for us. We want someone to rescue us. We want someone to be there and show up. And I'll talk about the way that that can show up in relationships in a second. So also dissociation, as we've talked about. Dissociation is that like leaving the body or not really being in the body. What does that mean, Chloe? That means that we can't feel our feet on the ground. That means that we can't feel or hear our heart beating in our chest. That means that we don't remember the last time we took a breath. That means that we have no idea what our body is telling us because we're very disconnected from it. That means that when we experience something that we can't differentiate between anxiety or excitement or fear or joy or love or passion or lust or anger or whatever it is, we are like a little checked out. And when dissociation gets bad enough, and going back to my theory about us, our soul kind of splitting off of ourselves in moments of trauma, if that happens enough times and is bad enough and extreme enough, then what can happen is this disorder called dissociative identity disorder, DID, which I'm going to have an episode about with one of the most amazing fucking DID practitioners ever, like true legend of a human and an absolute warrior of DID clients, a dear, sweet friend of mine and cohort member. So she'll come on at some point in the future to talk about that. We've already talked about dysthymia, which is that persistent sadness, kind of that everything coated in a touch of gray. And that can also look like suicidal ideation as a way of coping. Suicidal ideation, which, Chloe, what does that mean? Suicidal ideation means suicidal thoughts or the fantasizing and romanticizing of suicide or not being on the planet anymore. And suicidal ideation, it's like ideating about suicide or possibly being gone. That is a way to have control. If we've always felt out of control, even thinking about that as an option or fantasizing about suicide can be the only thing that we feel like we're in control of in moments of total despair. It can be this desire to feel free for a second, to just not have to feel the enormous amount of pain that we feel for a moment, to check out. And some people feel suicidal ideation more as like a numbing, like I just want to not feel anything, sort of like a coma. Whereas other people might feel suicidal ideation as I definitely don't want to be here anymore. Like infinite blackness, nothingness. That looks really great to me. And suicidal ideation is extremely normal, period, across the board in a human experience. And if it leads to coming up with a way to suicide yourself or a means or a plan, then that is when it's time to talk to someone. Probably beforehand, it's good to talk to someone if you're having suicidal ideation. One is just to normalize that experience and that life is extremely challenging and that it's okay to have that be a fantasy. I think probably every person on the planet has thought about that before. Not thought about doing it, but just thought about that as a fantasy idea, as a way to get through a moment. So, also, muscle armoring is a way that CPTSD can show up in a day-to-day or in situations, which is like the tensing of our muscles without us realizing. Sometimes I know how I'm feeling about something if I notice that my fists are clenched. Like all of a sudden I'll realize my fists are clenched and I'll think, oh, whoa, relax, let it go. What was I holding on to just then? What was I gearing up for? Or our legs will get tense in preparation to run. Or our bodies will get tense in preparation to freeze. And this can lead to us wondering why we have really sore muscles. So those are many ways that CPTSD can show up in a day-to-day, in life, in our internal experience. And I want to talk about what this might look like in relationship, really particularly in relationship with a romantic partner. This might look like going back to the constant search for a rescuer. If we are really desperate for someone to be our knight in shining armor, then someone who's extremely controlling and really jealous and very extreme with us can look like and feel like someone who's going to protect us and keep us safe and who loves us and who loves us so much that they're so mad that we love anybody else. And that, in a very small spectrum, is helpful, and it's really abusive and not helpful in most of those circumstances that shows up. That is really someone's deep stuff going on that needs tending to by them and needs care and their love that is separate potentially from a relationship to help them to not cause harm to themselves and others. This is a personal favorite. This can look like in relationships, this real deep wanting to be in a vulnerable and intimate and sweet and connected relationship, connection with someone. And the second that they mirror those desires, we fucking panic and run for the hills. Like, it's safe for us to love other people, but it feels totally unsafe for someone to reciprocate and love us back. That sends off those alarm bells. It feels like danger in the body and is really difficult to acknowledge sometimes. We can look for ways that someone shows all these red flags and look, dude, like their weird pinky toe or their morning breath or the fact that they feed their pet weird stuff is not a red flag. I don't mean it depends on what they're feeding their pet, but you know what I mean. Are we terrified to be loved really, truly? Because that would require us to lean in and be vulnerable and potentially put ourselves at risk of being hurt. Or do we hit the road and never look back and think, what a weirdo. Like, oh, good thing I got out of there. It's that brick wall. Well, I'm going to keep that out. God forbid any love gets in. Holy shit. Terrifying. In relationship, CPTSD can look like constant questioning of ourselves because it's really difficult for us to trust ourselves due to an abuser's rhetoric. Chloe, what does that mean? It means that whatever we were told and how someone treated us and what someone said about us and maybe gaslighting us can have an impact on how we don't trust ourselves anymore. We no longer hear our intuition as something worthy to be listened to. We see all of that as danger and, oh, we're totally broken, so we don't know any better. And, oh, I'm sure it's fine. They didn't mean it. Or that was just, you know, a few times and I'm sure it'll never happen again. I did this thing. I brought this upon myself. I must not, you know, it must be my past that makes me think that, you know, this experience was a big deal when it's totally not. And sometimes that's true and a lot of times it's not. What does that mean? If someone treats us really, really poorly, us questioning ourselves And whether or not we should feel like that is upsetting is so dangerous and not accurate. If we are in that other situation I just talked about where someone turns around and loves us back and we think to ourselves like, oh my God, yeah, well, I guess I don't love you anymore because you're, like those freckles are weird, or like, I don't know, like that one friend I don't like. That questioning ourselves and not leaning into that moment when it was what we wanted before, definitely question those things. But follow your intuition. Your intuition is sometimes going to feel like fear. It's going to be the thing that you know is the thing that's going to lead you to expansion, the thing that's going to help you grow, but there's going to be some rocky expansion and growth all the way there to learn and repattern that. Also, trust is lost extremely easily from someone who has CPTSD. So maybe we have someone in our lives, a romantic partner, who's really wonderful, treats us so great, and is lovely all the time, and we trust them. And then we ask them to do something and they don't do it. And all of a sudden we're like, oh my God, okay, well, I can't trust you now because I'm sure if you didn't do that one thing, then I can't believe anything you say anymore because, you know, that's, I gotta stay alive here. And now I'm gonna pull back. And that was our way to survive. That maybe we didn't have the luxury of trusting people, and that those little things were signifiers once upon a time for something worse or more difficult down the road as far as behaviors go. And I bless those people in the world who love and deeply cherish and tend to and care for and are so patient with those of us with CPTSD, because you all are angels. You're true angels, and your patience allows us to grow and learn and expand and like know love that's safe. So thank you. The feeling of being terrified of seeming vulnerable or needy, particularly at the beginning of a relationship, is very much like a trauma response, a chronic trauma response, because we're so scared that if we show any sort of vulnerability or messiness or any non-perfection, that we're then vulnerable to be taken advantage of and abused, and we don't necessarily trust ourselves to get out of that a situation like that more easily. Or maybe we freeze in situations like that. So avoiding them altogether makes sense to us. So we put on this illusion of, I'm perfect, I've got it all right. Like, oh yeah, I'm always happy. I feel things that, you know, like I'm just so joyful and I want to do all the fun things and I'm not nervous at all and I'm not overthinking and I'm probably not going to tell you I love you ever and I'll just be like, yeah, you're great or whatever. We won't lean into that. We don't want to ask for help. We'll be sick as dogs in our beds, in our houses, and people will find out and be willing to come over and bring us soup and tend to us. And we're like, oh no, it's fine. I'll be better in like 7 days. We'll like do whatever it takes to refuse being needy or vulnerable. We could break our arm and drive ourselves to the hospital before we're ever asking someone else to drive us. It's not great. And in a lot of these moments in these relationships, what I ask of those of you out there and those of us that love people with CPTSD is recognizing that we're not always going to be able to communicate. We're really working at it. We really want to communicate. We know that that would be more helpful for us, and it's crippling to do sometimes. And maybe it doesn't come out right and we say something mean that we don't mean, or we, you know, just turn into a puddle and don't know how to get back from that point. And we don't know if you're going to be there. We don't know if we tell you how we feel, or maybe we're upset by something, that you're not going to abandon us. We don't know that it's going to be okay. Those who experience chronic trauma may have an easier time leaning on more like passive aggressive forms of communication than direct communication, because that abandonment fear is extreme. It's extreme. And sometimes we've communicated things and they've fallen on deaf ears, or we've been made fun of, or we've been scolded and punished for them. So it's going to take some time and your patience and practice for us to get good at that, and to learn that we can say the things that we need and what we feel without fear of being persecuted for it. And also learning that sometimes we say what we need and we feel and people aren't down, and that's okay. Maybe they're just not people meant to be in our lives. Not personalizing it so much. So, yeah, those are some ways that it shows up in relationship. Got a brief story here about this practice called active imagination that I've discussed, that Carl Jung created. And in active imagination, it's essentially a visualization practice and kind of a meditation where you go to a place, usually an established place, and you meet archetypes and figures and parts of yourself there. And you learn a lot from yourself and about yourself and what's going on inside of you in that space. And one time I went into my active imagination space and I ended up spending time with 8 different versions of my child self. We're sitting on this grassy hill and I'm holding 2 different baby versions of myself at different ages. And I've got, you know, like 2-year-old me, 3-year-old me, 7-year-old, 8-year-old me, 5-year-old me, like all these versions of me around me. I just sat there and like listened to them and was with them. And seeing how special and unique each of them are, and how important they are, and how badass they are, and how wonderful they are. And an inner child process of healing and a way of establishing self-awareness and a way of beginning to know ourselves in a deeper level and care for ourselves to combat that shame and the internal negativity and the cognitive beliefs. I'm sorry, the cognitive distortions, is by going and being with ourselves in different parts. So for me, that day was really healing, of spending that visualization in this safe place with these parts of myself, just like loving them and being with them and giving them what they've never had. And coming out of that visualization and feeling like lighter and a little more safe in my body, and a little more confident, and a little more compassionate with my parents and with my childhood, and just showing all of that space and time care. I want to teach you all a couple of things. So one is, I don't think we're going to have time for all of it. So I'm going to teach you this one somatic practice, because we're already way over time. So this exercise I want to teach you, which I recommend doing if you have an opportunity to stand up wherever you are safely and to close your eyes, if that feels okay. You can also do it sitting down. It's okay as well. But definitely somewhere where you feel safe, where you can close those eyes. And you know what? You can do this with your eyes open if you got to. You're going to need both hands. So I want you to put one hand on your heart and one hand below your belly. and stand with your feet a little wider than hip width apart. Or if you're sitting, just sitting in a comfortable position, ideally with your hips higher than your knees. And if you're not sitting crisscross applesauce, having both of your feet on the ground, flat on the ground. So having one hand on your heart and one hand on your belly, I want you to slowly start swaying and rocking side to side. And taking deep breaths in through your nose and out through your nose. See if you can notice the warmth of your hands on your body. What it feels like to hold these parts of yourself. And really just ease into that rocking side to side motion. Feel yourself grounding deep into your body. When you're ready, take a big breath in. Big sigh out. Out of the mouth. Coming back to center. How does it feel now? This practice is a way of holding ourselves and loving ourselves. And rocking ourselves in that comfort like a mother would rock us. And tending to ourselves. And showing up for ourselves when we're really having a hard time or we're feeling scared or nervous, just as we would a small child. Just because our bodies have grown doesn't mean that we don't have a small child still in there that needs the same type of care we would have needed as babies. So that is our practice for the day. And lastly, I want to teach you all three ways of communicating that have radically transformed my life and are extremely helpful and effective tools for communication to just have on the ready to learn communicating more effectively. So particularly in relationships, in any relationship, I use this with roommates, family members, lovers, friends, coworkers. Well, some of them, people I know are down to communicate with me. I will include these in the show notes so they're written down so you don't have to try to remember them. The first is, I have this narrative, blank. Would you please confirm or deny it? This is a question that we can ask when we have those running thoughts. You've got this thing going on and we want to be accountable for our own stuff and also check in with those around us about what's going on. And we're going to get a lot of information from asking them. I still feel sometimes when I ask this thing, if someone denies the thing that I continuously need to relax myself, like I may not trust that response initially, and that over time, as the trust builds in that relationship, it's easier for me to take that direct communication back from them, the response from them, and see it as truth. So that first one was, I have this narrative that, and then you fill in the blank with what that narrative is, meaning like, I have this narrative that you don't like me anymore, you don't love me anymore. You don't want to be with me. where I have this narrative that I'm really annoying to you, and so you don't want to be bring me around your friends, or that your friends don't like me. Could you please confirm or deny it? A lot of the time, someone will be like, whoa, no, that couldn't be farther from the truth. I'm so glad you brought that up. Definitely not. You don't have to hold that anymore. It's all cool. And we can let it go and trust that that's true. Just work on trusting that that response is true. Or sometimes they're like, yeah, you know, I have been really struggling in this relationship and I'm struggling to feel as connected as I once did. And I'm willing to chat about what we can do about that and how we can connect closer, or what we need to do to adjust. But you're getting it direct information. There's no bullshit. The second one is when someone comes up to you that you know and like starts asking you about or telling you about something that's happening with them. Maybe it's like difficult or whatever the situation is. And you ask them, would you like me to just listen or offer solutions? This allows the person who is wanting to connect with you and tell you this thing, it gives you a really clear idea of how you can best show up for them in that moment. Because sometimes I'm telling someone a story and I just need to like vent a thing out and I don't need solutions. I got all the solutions. I got solutions for days. What I want is someone to just listen to me so I can get it out of my body. And if they've got the space for that, great. Maybe someone like really doesn't know what to do and they want some solutions. So you've opened that up and now you can really show up and support them by offering solutions. So asking clearly, what would you like or what would feel most supportive to you in this moment, for me to just listen or for me to offer solutions? This shows a lot of care and consideration, shows your presence with that person. And then when you're listening or you're offering solutions, then you're in collaboration, which is lovely. Very caring. One of my favorites, I really worked to practice this, especially since this was one of the hardest boundaries I ever learned. And a lot of this came from not feeling heard or listened to at all and really invalidated growing up in so many different areas of my life. I would just like spill out information and verbally dump on people around me. Sometimes I can be guilty for that, working on it still. But asking the person before you start rambling on or saying whatever you need to say is, do you have space at the moment to talk? When you ask, do you have space at the moment to talk? You're instantly showing that person that you have a lot of respect for them and their time and you care for them. And if they say, yeah, I do have time, then great, ramble on. But if they say, I don't have time right now, I'm doing this thing, but I have time in an hour, or, you know, there is time coming up here soon, or maybe like, I'm really drained, I definitely don't have time, I'm exhausted, we're gonna have to rain check this, then that's your time to honor that as well. Or find another outlet. Or write it down. Whatever you need to do. So, this was a lot of information. It's a really important conversation because I feel as if a lot of these responses or like behaviors show up in a lot of ways in our lives. And I find it to be really helpful to be clear on where that might have come from, or release ourselves from some of that shame so we can actually start moving through it, because we're going to have to love ourselves through it. And through it, not over it, around it, instead of it, the only way out is through. So hopefully this episode has helped you to have a better understanding of yourself or those people around you that you love, so that we can walk in beauty and with more compassion and gentleness and more patience and kindness and love and support for ourselves and others. Thank you so much for being here and for listening to this episode. It means so much to me that you've taken the time out of your day to spend time with me, to spend time with yourself. And in turn, when we take care of ourselves, that ripples out into the people that we love. Please like, follow, subscribe, and the best of all is to share. If you feel that this show would be a vital resource to someone that you know and love, send it their way. You never know how much it could actually help. If you'd like to support the podcast, the best thing that you can do is to write a review on Apple Podcast. Hearing what you think and seeing your reviews is such an amazing way for me to have a better understanding of what it is that you're really enjoying about the show. If you would like to connect with me, please feel free to email me at chloe@downwithmydemons.com. I love hearing from you. It's one of my favorite things. And please feel free to reach out if you have comments, concerns, questions, or to empower you with resources. Episodes come out Thursdays at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you would like to work with me one-on-one to get a little extra support on your shadow work path and a deeper understanding of what makes you the most magical you that you are, reach out to me and inquire for more details about that path. Again, thank you so much for being here. Time is precious. This world moves fast. And I really appreciate you taking the time to slow down, be present, digest it, take it in, or disagree, or rejoice, have whatever emotion comes up, and to be with it and feel it. I recommend while listening to this podcast that you have a support system to reach out to if need be. And if you don't, I'm happy to support for you. For every episode, I add resources to the show notes. So that's a great way to find at least initial things that you're looking for. Check that out below. Until we're with each other again, please be very gentle with yourself. Being human is super tough. I send you my love, warmth, and care. Take it easy.